Hello and welcome to Talk 200, a lecture and podcast series to celebrate the University of Manchester's bicentenary year. Our 200th anniversary is a time to celebrate 200 years of learning, innovation and research, 200 years of our incredible people and community, 200 years of global influence. In this series, you'll be hearing from some of the nation's foremost scientists, thinkers and social commentators, plus many other voices from across our university community, as we explore the big topics affecting us all.
In this bonus content to accompany the first episode of Talk 200, you'll hear the full panel discussion that followed Professor Sir Chris Whitty's live lecture titled Health Inequalities, Past, Present and Future. If you haven't seen Professor Whitty's lecture yet, head to manchester.ac.uk/talk200 to watch the full talk, along with the accompanying slides, as he discusses the main drivers of inequalities and disparities in health, how these have changed over time, and why addressing them remains a major public health priority. Continue listening to hear from our panel of experts, chaired by the university's President and Vice-Chancellor, Professor Dame Nancy Rothwell, as they continue the discussion with Professor Whitty.
Thank you very much, Chris. I loved the way you brought Manchester into so many of the discussions. Very nicely done. But can I, first of all, invite the other panellists to just introduce themselves briefly. Nikki?
Hi, everyone. I'm Nikki Cullum. I am Professor of Nursing here at the University and leading for the University on health inequalities at the moment, which is a major strategic imperative for the University.
Jay? And good evening, everybody. I'm Director of Population Health for NHSGM.
Great. So I'm going to ask a few questions. And the first one I'm going to address to Chris. But Chris, we all saw you very regularly on the television during COVID. What should we be doing now to prepare for another pandemic? Because surely there is likely to be one.
So I think what we shouldn't be doing is trying to write a plan for the next pandemic. Because if you think about the last really serious one we had, it was HIV. Different age group, 100% mortality in those who had it. Completely different routes of transmission, et cetera. So the idea you can just take a plan off the shelf clearly is incorrect. What we do need to do is have the building blocks ready to address almost any major infectious outbreak we can have. We will continue to have them for the rest of time. They'll go down different routes of transmission. Some will be oral, some of them will be respiratory, some will be sexual, some will be vector and so on. But I also think what we saw really clearly, and I hope that came across in one of the slides I showed early on, is a concentration of the worst impacts of COVID in areas of deprivation, as has happened with virtually every other infection previously. And what was really clear, and it is a real problem, is that we are not being effective at engaging with certain communities living in deprivation across the board. Not just on infectious diseases, vaccines and so on, but also on cardiovascular disease, also on mental health, also on maternal services and so on. So we must make much more effort, I think, to engage with communities and keep that engagement going rather than just starting to pay attention when a crisis hits. I think they rightly felt that we, in a sense, only woke up to the problems they were facing when there was a crisis, and that isn't correct.
And I'm sure you've seen the graphs, for example, in Greater Manchester, the vaccination rates map precisely onto areas of deprivation, and public trust is a big thing. So, Jane, can I just ask you, what ways, in your opinion, have healthcare systems adapted or failed to adapt to challenges posed by health inequalities? And what can we do about it?
I think healthcare systems could and should do more. However, I do think that integrated care systems are a major step forward, really. For the first time, integrated care partnership boards have a statutory duty to address health inequalities alongside their functions for population health and promoting social and economic development. And I think the place-based nature of integrated care systems mean that they have to work across traditional health boundaries, but also with non-health partners. And that means that they can focus not just on inequalities in access to healthcare, but also actually the drivers of ill health and the wider determinants. And that's really true where you've got mayoral combined authorities like we have in GM, because we have more of our hands on the levers of the causes of ill health, whether that's transport or housing, etc. But I think if I was thinking about reform, there are three things I think are really important. I think endurance is one. Health inequalities is a really long-term endeavor, and it needs to go beyond kind of political attention spans and planning cycles and leadership tenures. We need to focus on the long term, and we need to think about action in the short, medium, and longer term. And we also need to be really clear about what does success look like and how are we going to measure it. I think my second point would be around partnership approaches. No one agency or sector can do this. It's got to be a multi-agency effort. And we need to do a lot more really to develop the contribution of our communities around that. And then finally, I guess for me, a point about disruption. If we want upstream healthcare to be a mainstream model for us, and that's really important. You know, if you look at GM, 1.1 million of our population, or 4 in 10 of our population, live in the most deprived quintiles that you were describing earlier, Chris, which means we need our health system to respond to their needs properly. So we need universal healthcare, but proportionate and targeted to need. And that means a real shift in what the NHS prioritises, values and regulates. And if we want to hardwire health inequalities and take it seriously in our system, we need to think about endurance, partnership and disruption.
Thank you. Nikki, I mean, obviously a lot of this rests on health service, public health, etc. But what role can we as an academic institution or any academic institution play in alleviating health inequalities? And this is your day job, so it should be an easy one for you.
Well, I think Chris made some really brilliant points far more eloquently than I can in his lecture, actually. And some of that's about schools as academic institutions, and some of it's about universities and FE colleges, I think, actually. So increasingly, we've heard about the problems that children and young people have with mental health and well-being. I think schools probably play an important role in identifying that, in spotting that. And we have a major research program here based at the university called Be Well, which some of you were probably involved with, which is about working with school-aged children to really start to understand on a cross-sectional and a longitudinal basis what are the things that are driving their happiness and their unhappiness, and co-designing with them interventions to alleviate some of that. So we've got to understand it better, and that's exactly what Chris said in his talk. So I think they've got a role in sort of some data-driven insights, which universities can and are helping with, I think. In terms of universities, I think obviously we've got a major research role to better understand some of the root causes, to better work with, for example, our ICSs and help them with identifying what are the best evidence-based policies for early detection, prevention, secondary prevention, and help support those kind of policies in terms of rollout. But obviously the universities have also got a major role in education and training healthcare professionals, but also I think our wider student body in understanding the factors which underpin unfairness and inequalities in society, and understanding the more underserved groups and communities and what they need to be supported with in order to be more fully engaged with wider society in health and education. So I think one of the things that makes me really proud about you working at the University of Manchester is the civic responsibility, the social responsibility agenda. And I think we're probably at the beginning of a journey for that, really, which is about engaging the wider communities in everything we do, whether it's education or research or health research. And by doing more of that, I think it's part of the way in which we can reduce unfairness and inequalities.
So, I mean, this could be to any of you. Are there health systems around the world that we can learn from that do it better? I mean, there are many countries without a national health service, some with good. Can we learn from other places? I don't know who wants to answer that. Chris, you must have looked at quite a few international, but anybody else can do.
We learn most from countries that do things very differently to us, or countries that are very similar to us and taking a different line. So I watch what happens in Scotland, for example, because it's very similar. I'm also very interested in what happens in East Asia and Latin America, because they have a completely different approach. And many of the things that we've learned, I think, from those countries are things which you just think, I wouldn't have thought of that from first principles at all. It just doesn't follow the line we're going for. So those two seem to be the ones we can go to. There is no single group country you can look at and say, this is the answer. There are many countries that have got particular components that they do very well, including many low and middle income countries, which actually address, for example, community provision of healthcare often in an extremely imaginative way. And I think we should learn from them as well as learn from high income countries, which look more obviously our peers in terms of the ability of the health service to respond. So I think there is a lot to learn, but there isn't a country we can say, if only we were.
So anybody might want to answer this question as well. Do you think we need to redesign the way we train our healthcare professionals? Do we need a different sort of health education system to the one we have now?
Well, I don't know about a different education system. We certainly need a system that makes it more attractive for people to come into these professions and stay in the professions. I think one of the massive challenges we face is a workforce issue with across healthcare. And one of the reasons why we absolutely do, I think, need to learn much more from low and middle income countries in how we deliver prevention to broader sections of the community without lots and lots of healthcare professionals.
Just add into that, I think I speak to our provider organisations quite a lot, and they're really keen to say, how can we get a skills escalator and local employment pathways so that we make these careers attractive, but we're growing our own? And I think that would really help reduce health inequalities. And we need a workforce that is literate in health equity and that is fit for the future and can actually deliver services and you know, work with those communities that we need to work with, because it's in those communities at a hyper-local level where we're going to make the difference.
I mean, I think over my professional lifetime, training all the way through the system has become more and more regimented and less flexible. That is completely the wrong way to go. And I think we should be maintaining flexibility for people around their careers and also maintaining generalist skills, because multimorbidity will only be tackled if we move away from just saying everyone has to be a specialist. You can be a specialist and a generalist at the same time, and we should celebrate both. But I really think bringing back flexibility to the training system would have multiple benefits.
We've talked obviously a little bit about the healthcare system, about universities. What role do you feel that industry can play in this? I mean, obviously in terms of funding and development of new treatments, but actually in their workforces, removing health inequality in the workforce. Do we engage with industry enough?
I think we've got some good kind of private and public partnerships. I mean, Health Innovation Manchester is a key part of how we're working, isn't it? And I think those cross-sector partnerships are essential to bringing that additional capacity, the expertise and innovative thinking. And I think if we go back to COVID, the kind of partnerships we had with industry there and the rapid innovation we had in developments of the COVID vaccine, its rollout, were incredible. And I think we need to kind of make sure that we sweat that asset and really, you know, we have that capacity building and that knowledge exchange that is really important if we want to be cutting edge in Greater Manchester, Chris, and beyond.
Yeah, I mean, I think that leaving aside the ones where it's really obvious, like pharma and so on, I think there are two groups of bits of industry that we really, industry in the broader sense, that we don't engage with as much as we should. The first is engineering in the broadest sense of that term. If you look at most of early public health, it was engineering driven. If you want good housing, if you want people to be able to exercise, if you want people to have clean water and so on, it's engineers, but it's also the way they think through problems, and they have a different approach to people trained in biomedicine.
They do.
And it is extremely powerful, and actually learning from them and an approach to thinking. And I think universities like Manchester, which have both strength in both, are in a very strong position. The other way is that you know, most people will work in a private sector environment for 40 years of their life. And we've been incredibly unimaginative about using that time to promote health and decrease the chances that long-term ill health occurs. We've been very good at stopping accidents at work and occupational diseases. That's been a phenomenal response. Moderately good at dealing with people who got a fixed form of disability. It's not great, but it's better than it was. But there's a lot, you know, using it as health promotion, dealing with people in a way that allows them to continue a career if they've relapsing remitting conditions, I think we've got a long way to go on that. And I think we really need to have a proper rethink.
Yeah. And what role, we know there is already a big role, do we see as digital and AI in helping with the future of health and health inequalities? And along with that goes a big issue of public trust. You know, I had the scary figure that 43% of the population of Greater Manchester are not fully able to use health care apps or GPs and so on.
But I'm very confident that younger members of your university are using AI a lot more than you are.
Absolutely. I could absolutely not disagree with that. Yes. But we know there are big parts of the community, particularly the older parts, who are completely digitally illiterate.
AI is going to transform diagnostic radiology, for example.
Absolutely.
I think it'll transform diagnostic pathology, for example, slightly slower time. Some of the claims for AI, I think, are exaggerated, for no doubt about it. But as an ability to actually support us in what we're trying to do, I think it does have a major role. And I think we currently use it rather cautiously in education. And I think it will have quite a big role in helping people to learn things who aren't necessarily going through formal university, but actually could learn skills which are relevant to health and social care. So I think there's a lot positively we can do. Of course, all the caveats need to be put underneath that.
Yeah, we do have quite a large and a very eminent group in Digital Trust, and we're now looking at broadening that into Digital Trust and cybersecurity and safety of online data, which I think is going to be a big issue for future.
Well, I mean, I think one of the challenges is access to data for research purposes and for doing research with routinely available data that can then improve health overall. I think things are moving quite fast in that space. It's still painfully slow, I would say. So the quicker that we can make that smoother, the better. When we've done some research here in the past on trust, though, we did a citizens jury, and people's decisions about which organisations they would trust with their health data were quite nuanced, actually. All were not equal. So I think there is, there's a job to be done.
Also, I mean, one of the things, we all criticise it, but what is probably a huge and underused asset is our National Health Service and the data within it. We still haven't really cracked the use of that. When you look at us, many companies in the States want to come in here and use our data because they just don't have it.
I mean, I do think that's one of the important things is thinking about a knowledge power NHS, so that actually all the data we're gathering around individuals and their interventions, that we're putting that to good use in terms of learning. And I think we now have a very good longitudinal data set and an advanced data science platform. So we've got some unique data architecture here that I think will be really attractive to industry and to researchers around what was possible in terms of understanding patients over a long time. We've got a lot of linked data that would enable us to really, really do some amazing research.
Yeah, Chris?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. We need it for patient management. We need it to help make the system better. We need it for research. But we must take the public with us. And it's absolutely essential that we maintain trust, maintain openness, accept when things go wrong, all of those things. Because if we don't do that, we'll go ahead of where the public are, and then we'll end up with disasters.
So I'm going to open up to the audience in a minute to ask questions, but first I have one question I have to ask each of you, and it's called a golden thread question, because it's going to be included across all of our lectures and podcast series, which is, what do you hope our third century will bring us, the University of Manchester, in this area?
If I don't go first, they'll say the things.
All right, go on then, quick.
So, well, I think it's got to be much more about breaking down the walls of the university and being much more part of the community that surrounds us, but for educational purposes in a very holistic, broad sense, as well as doing research with our citizens, not on our citizens. So I think we are a fantastically civic-minded university, but I think we should make a step change in taking that further.
So, Jane, Nikki, taking your answer.
So I think I'd value it if we had a nation where health was really valued as a primary asset for driving the economy and driving happiness. and that we had a preventative state that was foundational, so that we're really investing in communities and that the community infrastructure. I think that's been lost over time in terms of we've got very transactional public services now. I think we need a prevention first NHS that's people powered and knowledge powered, and also health promoting environments where we're using our policies to drive making the healthier choice the easier choice.
Well, I hope that when a CMO in 100 years gives a talk in your 300th year, they'll be able to say this is the century in which we got rid of the great majority, if not all, of the diseases of premature mortality, 75, including in the areas of deprivation, that we took away the risks and dangers of many of the treatments for things like cancer we've got in them. We're beginning to see a direction of travel, but there's a long way to go. But above all, that we had shrunk the period of morbidity, not extended it by the work we've done. And if we'd achieved that, I think we could look back on what we did with some pride, although, of course, by then we'd be dead, so we wouldn't know. But, you know, the principle is there.
Thank you. And one of the things we've touched on but not really focused on is the massive economic impact. I mean, I think it was one of your colleagues who calculated that a third of the gap in productivity between the North and the South is poor health, which is shocking, actually. So aside from well-being and what's socially correct and all the rest of it, we could dramatically improve the economy of the weaker parts of the country. I'm going to now open up for questions. Can you wait, Matthew?
Hiya, I'm Matthew Moss from the University of Manchester. It was really just picking up on the conversation around digital innovation and taking people with you. But it's two aspects to it. There's been a lot of talk about the impact it might have, positive impact it might have on health system reform, but also whether you could talk a little bit more as well about that, but also on disease prevention. You mentioned it, but just that feels like a massive area of opportunity.
Which game passed?
Okay, I'll go first, I'll be brief. I think we saw in COVID a loosening of the rules because we had to. It allowed an acceleration of what we were able to pick up in terms of risk factors for disease, then treatments for disease, then prevention of disease with vaccines. And it also allowed us to learn a lot about the interactions with other diseases. That was extraordinary. And I don't think anybody felt that their privacy was being eroded, that they were being done down by this. We need to get that balance right, but it was a demonstration of what we can achieve. And I don't think we should go back to where we were previously, because there are so many other diseases, particularly in areas of deprivation, where getting indirect data, maybe the best data we'll get, to allow us to focus our aims to reduce avoidable mortality and morbidity, particularly in younger age.
The big thing that we're focusing on in 24-25 in Greater Manchester is our approach to population health management, and particularly important that is the digital tools that we've been developing around CVD need and also around risk stratification, which Nikki was just talking about then. And they're incredibly important in terms of understanding our need, where it is, and really developing person-centred care that addresses health inequalities and targets resources and effort where it needs to be. So I think that's going to be a massive focus for us in 24-25.
I think, Aravind, you had a question?
Professor Vidi, you mentioned this very briefly in one of your slides, but for everybody on the panel, could you say a bit more about diet and lifestyle, you know, active versus sedentary lifestyles, and how that could correlate to health outcomes? Because naively, that may not be such a linear correlation to deprivation.
I think there are two separate things. Diet and exercise are two separate things. And I think we shouldn't fall into the trap of thinking that exercise can undo the effects of an unhealthy diet. It can't. It has a huge risk reduction of multiple diseases of its own. And anybody who goes to areas which are in areas of deprivation will see that getting safe exercise for children, for elderly people and so on is harder. That's just a practical reality. It is harder. It's also often, interestingly, harder in rural areas. They look as if you should be able to get out there, but the first mile, there won't be a pavement along the road. If you're not a young person who can leap onto the bank when the car comes around the corner, you actually can have no access to this. So I think the exercise does tend to correlate with deprivation to some degree, but the dietary problems are much greater. And we have not worked out a way anywhere in the world, in my view, or certainly anywhere in the Western world, of identifying how we can have people have a diet that they are enjoying, satiated by the diet and they're enjoying it, and a diet that doesn't lead to obesity when they're having to do it on very, very small incomes. And this is really problematic. And I think this is really the key to those shocking data where the graph showing a gradient of obesity. We have to find a way of making it affordable and attractive if we are actually to try and reverse this trend. And I don't think we've got a good path to this at this point in time.
Jane, and you might also want to comment on government intervention, you know, taxes on sugar, taxes on fat, whatever. Which
I actually think when you get into the lifestyle factors of alcohol and obesity, that actually is those population level interventions that are really, really important. And I think we need a stronger state and regulation around some of those things. And, you know, childhood obesity is a disease of deprivation. It is very much about the environment and the commercial determinants. And again, I think there's a lot more we need to do around commercial determinants at a national level, but also supported what we can do at a city regional level. And we're doing some work at the moment around restricting junk food advertising. We did some work with our youth CA around the advertising that they were exposed to on their way to school. And it's absolutely kind of significant. And we can't expect young people to kind of want to eat healthier things when they're so exposed to that in their day-to-day environment. So for me, when you're looking at those lifestyle issues, we need to think a lot more about what we can do at a population level and policy and regulation.
We haven't even touched on the crisis in dental at the moment, which is multiple, but a very big one. I think I can see Ashley waving from the back. Is that you, Ashley?
So I'm a respiratory physician, and I've, in my working career, seen the enormous benefits from reduction in tobacco and the related diseases. And part of that's been the prescription of nicotine replacement therapy. And so we get into a good place with that. But of course, now we see uncontrolled use of nicotine therapies, vapes, for example, which is giving us a whole new generation of addiction, I think. And I just wondered what the panel thought, professionally, especially Professor Whitty, I think, about the balance of benefits here. It seems to me it's not straightforward.
Obviously, the absolutely ideal is to get to a position where nobody is smoking, and the smoke-free generation will do that over time, we hope, but obviously it doesn't help people who are smokers now. I think, you know, my summary of it has always been, if you smoke, vape. If you don't smoke, don't vape. And if the advertising to children is utterly unacceptable. That's the summary. The problem we have is that the vape industry, which was sort of allowed through the door because it is useful to help some smokers who are addicted to nicotine come off smoking, it's a very strong step in the right direction, then chanced their arm and extended it out and did exactly what the cigarette industry did, started advertising firstly covertly and then blatantly to children and to young people to try and get people who are not smokers addicted on nicotine by using colours, flavours, free samples and so on, all these marketing techniques. So I think there's a bill coming to Parliament at the moment. I consider it a very major step in the right direction. I don't think it's a panacea. I very much hope that people of all political parties will support it. The public overwhelmingly support both stopping smoking and restricting very heavily vaping. And I think we just need to take on the bogus argument that somehow being in favour of something which is highly addictive, heavily marketed at children and then kills them, is somehow pro-choice. That is an unacceptable illogicality given the extraordinary damage that causes. But I do think that we need to restrict the vaping. And what's been interesting to me when I see this debate is that people who come from a child health point of view, like the Royal College of Paediatrics, would essentially like to ban everything pretty well. And those who come from a trying to help smokers to stop do want to have a range of options to help people stop something which they don't want to do. Their choice has been taken away from them. They're now nicotine addicted, and this allows them a way off. And getting the balance right between that will probably take some adjusting. And for that reason, in the bill that's going to Parliament, it's taken as powers. And what that means is we can kind of sense dial it up or down depending on whether we think we've overdone it or not gone far enough. That's a shortish answer to an important question. But I do think we need to avoid a situation where we go back to arguing about vaping when actually the big prize is getting rid of smoking. That is the number one priority. And we mustn't allow anything to stand in that way.
Thank you. Yes, we've got a few questions on Slido that have received a number of upvotes. One of the most popular has been asked by Tom Spate, who's asked the following. British Heart Foundation analysis shows that we have the highest under 75 mortality of coronary heart disease in over a decade. Have we lost progress on previous successes?
Who wants to answer that?
I think CVD has been a success story in terms of what we've achieved, but I think some of that has stalled over recent time, and we do need to, I think particularly the pandemic has maybe slowed some of our progress, and we've gone backwards in terms of our healthy life expectancy, etc. So I think we do need to regroup around how we can really get the targeted support out there to people who need it and use some of those things we talked about before, the digital tools, etc., to really drive more person-centered care to deliver it where people need it. So I think there's a very strong evidence base around CBD, and we know what we can do in terms of if we optimize our treatment of high blood pressure and lipids, etc., we can deliver a lot. And that's the kind of thing that we are looking at in Greater Manchester in GEM for next year, is really focusing on CBD prevention and what we can do, because the evidence base is so strong. And so that's going to be a really key focus for our total system across primary and secondary care next year.
I completely agree. We have gone backwards, not a huge distance, but we shouldn't be going backwards. We should be going forwards. In a sense, I think the first thing we need to do is get back to where we were just pre-pandemic, getting the primary prevention obviously in place, but the secondary prevention, identifying people with risk factors, addressing those risk factors, and early treatment for those who need it. And both of those have been eroded during COVID for entirely predictable reasons, really. But then we should also accept that there was pre-pandemic an enormous burden of avoidable heart disease in populations we were not getting to. And I think this is where, to go back to the point that Nikki and others have made, we need to re-engage with those communities, because they weren't being engaged for secondary prevention, they weren't being engaged for indeed trying to reduce down the societal risks of cardiovascular disease. And I think we know where they are. We really must redouble our efforts to engage on them in the longer term, because otherwise we're going to kind of reach a plateau where we know what to do when people are wealthy and they engage in the health service, but we leave a large group of people unengaged and therefore suffering premature mortality that is entirely avoidable.
Thank you. And another popular question online has come from an anonymous member who's asked, how does ethnicity impact on health inequalities, and what can be done to deal with this issue, especially in multicultural Manchester?
Within ethnicity, it's important to differentiate the effects on ethnic minority groups due to deprivation, whereas simply that there's a concentration of people in certain ethnic minority groups in areas of deprivation, and the things which are biologically associated with having a particular heritage. And almost every ethnic group has certain things they're more likely to have and certain things they're less likely to have. For example, people born who are UK white heritage are more likely to have certain genetic conditions than some of the other groups, of which cystic fibrosis would be a fairly clear one. People of Asian heritage, South Asian heritage, will often have higher rates of diabetes, all other things being equal, at an earlier stage. But a very large amount of the ethnic differences we see in the UK are not that. They are actually a proxy for deprivation and concentration of deprivation, and we should see it as something where we've really got to tackle the deprivation, and that is the principal way in which we will address many of these problems.
I had the privilege of leading the vaccination efforts in Greater Manchester during the COVID pandemic, and ethnicity was a key factor both in mortality around COVID, but also in terms of uptake, in terms of vaccination. And I think we learned a lot about how we need to co-produce solutions with the community. We need trusted faces, spaces and voices, and we need very different models of provision that reach out and are hyper-local for some of our groups, and we need culturally appropriate services. So I think we've learned a lot about what we need to do, and we've developed our thinking. However, I do think we need to make sure that some of our commissioning and contracting allows us to deliver these different approaches that we learned so much about during the pandemic. I feel we've gone backwards a little bit on that.
Thank you. Yes, another question that's just come through from an anonymous member of our online audience has asked a COVID-related question. And they've asked, did Manchester, having a devolved health care system, have an impact on the city's response to COVID-19?
Yeah, so I think because we've got such well-established partnership arrangements, I think we were more able to kind of mobilise a whole system effort, both in terms of the governance we set up and the leadership, and also in terms of how we used our resources. So I think we were quite agile then in terms of our response and making sure we were corralling all our system resources together. So I definitely saw that. I definitely saw that difference in terms of how we responded in Greater Manchester on the issue. So I think it did make a difference.
Yes, I'll take one more question.
Hi. So I'm thinking about health inequalities, past, present, and future, and thinking about a future of climate change and that impact on health inequalities. Is there any comments from the panel on how we can try and address those two things together?
Interesting one. Climate change and health inequality. Gosh, well, around the world, it's going to be tough.
I mean, there's a whole huge research agenda there, isn't there, that I know we're grappling with, as are hopefully lots of other people. And the funders are seeing the importance of it as well.
Things that drive health inequalities also drives the climate change crisis, and a lot of the answers are the same. So again, what's one of the things we've done in Greater Manchester in our Fairer Health for All approach is actually combine the two ambitions, really. The sustainability and our inequalities agenda go hand in hand.
Yeah, I think there's an international answer and a domestic answer.
Yeah, sure.
On the international side, unfortunately, some of the countries that will be most affected by climate change early, it's going to affect all countries, are some of the ones who have the greatest levels of poverty and the least ability to respond to them. So that's at an international level, that's a fundamentally problematic and very unfair situation we're in. And then domestically, we know that for some of the effects of climate change, humans, but not all other species, can buy their way out of trouble, but only the wealthy can buy their way out of trouble. And so unfortunately, I think this will exacerbate differences in a bad way rather than anything else. So I think we should, unfortunately, that's one of the many reasons we need to tackle climate change forcefully.
So I'm going to take the privilege of the last question, which is a cheeky question, and it's one just to Chris, but it's a question I bet loads of you want to know the answer to. How on earth did you get through that incredible time of COVID when you were on the television nearly every day, I'm sure, in meetings? And by the way, we're not the inquiry, so you can give a short and a bland answer or a longer one. But for us standing back, it was pretty hard. For you, it must have been an incredibly difficult time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not someone who particularly enjoys being on television, so I didn't enjoy it, let's put it that way. But it's if you take on these kinds of jobs, you have to accept the rough with the smooth on them. My kind of view was that's the job I was given. I've got to do it to the best of my ability. I was incredibly fortunate to be supported by an incredibly good team. And I think for many people in COVID, they were on their own in their environment, working from home, often with not very good communications. It got better as the pandemic went on. So counterintuitively, I had the advantage of a team around me and human contact, which helped me. At the same time, of course, I did have to have exposure, which I wasn't ready for, and I was on a very steep learning curve, to be honest, but there you go. But yeah, teams make an enormous difference.
Yeah.
And I think that's true across all of healthcare, whether it's nursing, medicine, science. You really rely on your teams. Building a good team around you makes absolutely terrific difference.
I should add something that Chris said in another venue. It was good working in teams, but not going to any parties, I recall.
To stay up to date with everything Talk 200, be sure to follow and subscribe to the series on the podcasting platform of your choice. Head to manchester.ac.uk/200 to find out more about this series and all the activity taking place across our bicentenary year, including our free festival, University Manchester, from the 6th to the 9th of June. Use the hashtag UOM200 to engage with Talk200 and our wider bicentenary celebrations on social media. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Talk 200, a University of Manchester series. Until next time.